Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land that we are broadcasting from. Also, I'd like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. Thank you for joining us this morning. This morning wasn't that cold. Last night wasn't that cold. There was a bit of rain going around last night, which was good. And out there, wash the car. It means I didn't have to wash the car. And out there, we're under a tree. And it's where bats sleep. And then,
why don't park your car there, bro?
Yeah. Oh, no, like that's the part of the park.
Oh, yeah.
Like where we have to park our car in a driveway. It's a weird driveway. But also in the studio with me this morning again is Carve Watson. How you going, Carve?
Going good. Good
that's
morning.
Good. That's good. And for our listeners as well, your mob, your country?
My mob, Birriggubba and Kungaloo people of central Queensland, inland from Rocky or on the Dawson River. And inland from Mackay, a place called Nebo, and Great Granny was Proserpine as well, up around with Sunday's Way.
Yeah, deadly. We also have a guest on the phone with us, joining us all the way from Stradbroke Island.
Caillou Bales.
Caillou Bales, yes. And that's sort of your half, your better half's country as well.
North Stradbroke Island, North Stradbroke that's Island, it. Yep. And Caillou's me mob. Good morning,
yep,
Caillou.
Good morning, everybody.
How you going, sis?
Going good. How can you complain? They live in here.
That's it. Yeah.
I reckon. It's always get a bit. It's always a little bit rainier over there when it rains over town. No way.
Yeah, but I'm not silly enough to complain about that. You know, we got we got the lakes that need filling up, looking a bit low, and you know we live on an aquifer, so all that water's good.
Ah, deadly.
Just before we get into the yarn, too, sis, could for our listeners, your mob and your country as well.
Yeah, sure. Just before that, just want to acknowledge the elders, past, present, future, and a continuing sovereignty of all the people of the land, as well as the traditional owners there, the Yuggera and Turrbal mob. Like to pay my respects to them and everybody listening across the land there where this is broadcast. My mob are the Wanarua. I identify as a Wanarua woman from Hunter Valley. That's my mother's mob. My father's mob, Awiri, Gungaloo, so Awiri from up Serena, Nebo, Mackay Way, North Queensland, and the Gungaloo, Waka Waka mob, inland of Rockhampton and Warrabinda.
Thanks, that sis. Biggest mob?
Biggest mob, right?
Hey.
Hey, that's only a little bit. I left a few out.
Yeah.
A
long. Yeah. We got you on the program this morning, sis, just to have a yarn about the new program that yourself and your son put together. It aired last night at 6 o'clock every Wednesday from 6. It's a 10-part series. Could you tell us about the 10-part series?
Firstly, gotta give props to the station there and BEMA, Brisbane Indigenous Media Association, for their support and ongoing commitment to help Tiger and I get this off the ground. Without them, we couldn't do it. Big thanks to Uncle Carver. He was a big player there to make sure that we had what we needed to do to get the job done. So without him, it couldn't have got done. And also, just want to mention this is a very special project to me and Tiger especially. You know, it meant a lot to bring this program to life because it was something that Dad spoke to me about. And funnily enough, after Dad passed, I got yarn and the mob, and nobody else had seemed to add the yarn with that. So it felt like I had the hot potato and I had to run with it. And at that time, with Dad being sick, I was struggling to find out how we can improve things. We were losing. Dad was like number 12, I think, in our immediate family that we'd lost prematurely, due to living conditions, really. And I was struggling when we lost Dad. So it was a natural thing to start thinking, how do we get back to bush tucker? And then words, decolonize your diet. It was just going around in my head. So it's a very special project to be able to do something that only Dad and I spoke about when he was here, to continue through, and especially to be able to do it with my son, young Tiger. It's a very special project.
Mm. Now, you know, people who knew your father knew that he's very conscientious about his diet and you know, food and that sort of stuff. But, you know, people who knew your mum know that they were like that as that, you know, she was very conscientious as well, Kai. So could you sort of speak about, I guess, you know, some of, you know, your earlier education and the importance of food and what we, you know, and our nutrition and that sort of stuff leading up to, you know, I guess the program?
Well, look, if the stuff that I came across while researching this program blew my mind, having a mum that was a naturopath back in the 80s, like we grew up with the honey, similar to you know, Carver, we grew up with the honey, the brown bread, the goat's milk, you know, we never had any white sugar, we never had white salt, we were pretty, you know, like, well, no, there wasn't many people living like us unless you're in the bush, you know, brought up old way, and our family managed to, you know, keep that sort of stuff going, where we were very aware of the white flour, the white sugar damage and stuff like that. So we were lucky, but it wasn't until I did this program that I realised just how little we knew about looking after ourselves. I'm nearly 40, and I'm only just learning now, thanks to this old fella, you know. When I'm doing that research, the penny drops and I think, this is what it's all about. Now I get it. This is what you wanted us to do this for, Dad, you know, like, we didn't, I don't know if you followed me, but before the program, even having a naturopath mother, I did not know that food was the number one killer in the world, above homicide, above car accidents, above shooting, above, you know, murder, above drug and alcohol death. Did you know that food was the biggest killer?
No, I didn't
know. Human,
like,
globally.
So that would include sort of like the conditions that are caused by poor diet, yeah?
Well, yeah, and poverty.
Yeah.
Because, we're all looking for calorie-dense food for the less amount of money, so we're getting food that's not even really food anymore. And my mum used to call the food, like she'd call pizza muck-muck. She'd say that's flour. You know, she'd call bread glue. She'd say that's water and flour. She really broke things down for us in an old blackfella way.
Mm.
So, you know, I really did get to appreciate my mum more in the end. You know, she was, as fair as she was red hair and freckled, she was living like an old tribal woman. You know, she made sure that they didn't put them needles in us, and I know that's controversial, but I'm telling you, she didn't give us antibiotics. She fed us up on vitamins. We had immunity, natural immunity, you know, like, and I just started to realise just how important it was that mum talked to us about this, because at the end of it, by the time I got to talk to Damon Gemmo, you know, which is towards the end of the series, he's telling us about how, you know, 70% of the food that we eat today didn't exist before the Industrial Revolution. So mum talking about McDonald's being McDonald's and the pizza being muck-muck and the bread being nothing but glue, flour and water, is exactly what Damon's, you know, sort of hitting home today. And on top of that, mum used to also talk about not corrupting our taste buds. The biggest blowout for me, on top of the fact that food was the biggest killer, was the sugar. From the day we are born, we are basically born addicted to sugar on this West, since the introduction of Western diet.
And the thing where we get our food now as well, like in the supermarket, you know, shelf life is actually like, part of the estimate when you're selling a product, especially through supermarkets, you know what I mean? So you've got preservatives and stuff in there to make it last longer than it otherwise would, which isn't, you know, a natural sort of nutritious, you know, ingredient.
But it's a long way from its natural state.
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying it's hardly called food anymore. That's why mum was calling it muck-muck and McDonald's, you know?
Yeah. Now, it is a 10-part series. What is the first episode that we heard last night? And for people, listeners out there, you can check it out via the podcast. We'll have that up today. What was the first episode about?
The first episode is called The Oldest, Most Nutritious Food on Earth, and it's an interview with John Newton, who wrote the book called The Oldest Food on Earth. And John's an internationally acclaimed food critic who stumbled across the benefits of Bush Tucker while he was, you know, dining and writing up his reviews all around the world. And it really complements the work of Dark Emu by Uncle Bruce Pascoe, who we'll be talking to later, later on the third episode, and also complements the work of Bill Gemmage, which a lot of people in Australia are definitely aware of. with the biggest estate on earth, his book. It's crazy, but the thing that stuck out with me after the interview with, I call him Uncle John, because I've never met a more down-to-earth, genuine, respectful, just wanting to learn proper way from blackfellas. And when I meet people like that, I acknowledge them like Mob. You know, we all are Mob, and I call him Uncle John. He told us that there's 6,000 different varieties of native flora and fauna and food to be eaten in Australia. Most countries only have a selection of 150 of native cuisine, in the native cuisine. You know, like, I cannot believe, like, and he talks about the nutritious value, he talks about the stigma, you know, with the racism in the restaurants and everything. But when he talks about the medical benefits and how much we have to choose from and all of this, it's like, well, why aren't we getting it? You know, like, I suppose, and that question becomes more and more, you sort of want to ask it more and more every time you interview somebody, and you find out that the mainstream model of health, for example, just going, like, putting it in context now with the whole series, when you look at the mainstream model of health, it's nothing more, the Aboriginal model of health is exactly the same but with a different name. You know, so we know very clearly from the data that's available that our blackfella food, those 6,000 different varieties of food, are much more higher in nutrition, so they've got a higher nutritional content and are better for us than the Western food. The Western food is, you know, is shown to kill us. When you have a look at the introduction of Western food, it's very clear that that's the reason for the demise of our, or the decline of our health and our well-being. And, I mean, you just wonder, why aren't they using the data? It was in the 70s, Dr. Karen O'Day, who I interviewed in the series as well, took a bunch of blackfellas from the bush, from the city back to the bush. They used to live in a bush setting. And after 7 weeks on bush tucker, their obesity, the kidney disease, the heart disease, everything disappeared. And they weren't even, it all reversed. All of those markers, all those indicators were reversed in just 7 weeks. And they weren't out hunting all the day. They weren't active all the time. So, like, why, if we've got that data, if we know that the introduction of Western food was the beginning of our problem, and we now know the data, you know, we've got the data to show how important our food is to closing the gap, why aren't we introducing, you know, a new Indigenous health strategy that incorporates our bush tucker and our healing models that are now being incorporated into Western settings as well? You know, like, we know what's best. The data's there. We've got, since the 70s, all of the research is obviously, you know, it's out. The results are in. You know, we know what works for us, yet we're still using a Western model of health.
Mm. Is there much discussion around, you know, the loss of, you know, different plants and flora and fauna that we, you know, that could be consumed, because we know that ecocide is a real problem, and, you know, we have one of the largest extinction rates for, you know, not only animals but also plants and that as well. Is there some concerns around being able to preserve, you know, all these different types and categories of food sources?
Yeah, look, I got to the point where I realised that there's going to have to be another series two, which will cover food sovereignty, you know, like, we really, that's what it comes down to at the end of it. You can't just promote, you know, going to get into your blackfella food when it could be depleted, or yeah, it could be contaminated by mining and diesel oil or oil spills in the ocean, yeah, you know, or you know, radiation leaks, whatever. You've really got to be mindful that we've got to be responsible, you know. We can't just encourage everybody to go out and kill a roo. We can't encourage everybody to even go in and be part of the roo industry, because it's not done, you know, it's not done ethically, it's not done sustainably. So we do need to concentrate on food sovereignty, food security, bush tucker, you know. So once we actually start to realise the benefits and the advantages, then people are going to have to start, you know, taking proactive measures to make sure that we do have our own secure, you know, sustainable supplies in community, and we can have some sort of ethical, we can offer our friends and family, you know, an ethical supply rather than not knowing how good it is or whether we're going to have some for our kids.
Now, naturally, this would have started for you, you know, when you think about your, you know, your boys, your kids and your nephews and nieces and own family and that, but do you see that there's you want non-Indigenous people to be engaged in this and be thinking about, you know, the preservation and sustainability of Indigenous foods and that?
it's interesting you say that because John does, Uncle John does raise this in the interview where he says that ANFIL, which is the governing body for bush foods and stuff, they're actually looking at ways that they can, you know, ensure a responsible supply, a sustainable, ethical supply. So they'd need something like a supply nation, you know, a governing body or something to oversee where they get that tick of approval that they're supplying it properly. I think until we get that sort of system happening, it's probably not, I can't promote mob, you know, getting into the bush tucker industry if they're not in community, if they've not got bloodline to country. I'm looking at weeds. I know that it's weird, but there's a lot of stuff in the backyard that you can use, and it's the safest because it's not got pesticides and stuff like that that can live for 1,000 years in the dirt.
Are you still asses? Don't you just drop out? Yeah, it must have. Well, I'll try and give her a call back as well. But I know shortly we're going to be yarning with Tammy Solinek from Amnesty International. She's the Indigenous Rights Manager there. And we were going to have a yarn. We're going to yarn about what's happening over in the NT at the moment. There's been reports coming out that 100% of the population of the youth incarcerated are Aboriginal. So we're going to have a yarn about that.
Yeah, she's back. Hey, look out.
What happened?
I don't know. You just dropped out there.
I couldn't hear you for a while. I was just on quiet.
Yeah, you come back. Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask, like you were explaining how it's sort of not – well, like when, you know, like Western diets are very, very like that. Like that's not accessible for poor people, for people not earning much money. What does, you know, I guess like a decolonized diet look like and how accessible are those foods?
Okay, what I'd suggest is what we're doing as a family is we, after talking to Clint Bussey, who's been working in Aboriginal communities as a nutritionist for 30 years, he's a white fella, but he's, you know, where his heart is, you can tell when you listen to him. He suggests just aiming at 20 to 30% increase in your diet. We can't exactly go back to live in the bush, you know, so if you can make a constant effort, maybe once a week, to gather your food. If you have to go to Woolies and grab that kangaroo meat, you do it by any means necessary, you know. You get that opportunity to go back to country. You just make more of a focus, and you'll notice that it's more of a way of, it becomes a way of life. There's nothing more special than carrying that little baby you got on your hip, you know, gathering some berries outside of town while everyone else is just, you know, you know, yeah, just going to work every day and getting caught up. There's nothing better than chucking a line in, going fishing. Just break that cycle and just aim at, in the first 12 months, aim at trying to get to 30% bush tucker and take it from there. That's what I'm suggesting.
Yeah, deadly. And, yeah, because...
And, you know, and the other thing is affordable affordable access to food is another thing. We need to have a look at Oz Harvest and Second Bite. These are the people who provide healthy... you know, affordable food that's left over from Coles, Aldi, Woolworths. They provide that to our community for very, very minimal prices. So we really need to make sure that even the best of the Western varieties is available to us too in saying that.
Is, like, the Western sort of diet, is that sort of detrimental to our health? Or does that sort of, yeah, like what's the comparison between, like, us using the sort of model that, like, the series that you're talking about?
Well, when you're talking about eating foods high in fat, high in sugar, high in, you know, starchy foods, flours and carbohydrates, we never had any of that. You know, that's what's making us obese. That's what's contributing to the whole world. Like, the whole world didn't eat any of that boat 500 years ago. They never ate that stuff. It's only since the introduction of, you know, farming, that the Western idea of agriculture, that we all started to eat more grains and we started to step away from the old ways. So when you're eating a Kakadu plum, for example, Bar, that's got 1,000 times more vitamin C than the Western orange. That's the highest thing they got. You know, like that's in their variety. The highest content is their citrus. The highest content of vitamin C. Ours is 1,000 times stronger. And then we've got, and you know, and the saddest thing about it is, we are the last ones to know that there could be a root outside there that'll fix up your diabetes. You know, just make a tea out of it. We're the last ones to know that the midgenberry, what the benefits of that is, that's right outside our doorsteps, or the native raspberry. You know, we're the last ones to know. You know, the first ones to know are the billionaires ready to go in there and patent that stuff and make it theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the big thing that I want to get across here is this is a chance for a real health revolution for all of us, you know. Like, if white fellas want to come into this, there is a way to do it with integrity and ethically. They need to make sure, like John says, that proceeds go back to community, mm-hmm. that you're working with black fellas. You know, so I think that we can create a real health revolution here where white fellas and black fellas can relearn this country and what better, you know, the history of this country and what better way than to sit down and have a meal and talk about the benefits of bush tucker. Or, you know, I think the thing that I came away with from the whole series, to be honest, was it wasn't about food. It was so much more than food. The amount of history that I came across that I didn't know, even though I thought I was aware, while I was researching this, about the true history of our people, like our habits, you know, the genius systems, the seasons, and how much we observe nature and we're able to be, you know, just slot in there perfectly and put ourselves in balance with that. The story, I feel gypped after learning about what Bruce Pascoe teaches, learning about what the land really looked like, you know, from Bill Gemmage's books and Uncle Bruce's book and Uncle John's books. I feel gypped. All of us have been gypped. None of us have really learned the true history, so I think it's a really good way to start through food. Mm,
definitely.
Deadly.
We're going to have to wrap up now, sis, but just before we finish, 6 p.m. Wednesdays, Decolonize Your Diet by Caillou and Delaney Bales, mother and son combo. Also, what can we expect in the next in the next few series, I guess?
Bill Gemmage would be the next one in the next episode. We just talked there about what the country looked like a gentleman's estate, basically. And this is where we start getting into the interesting stuff about, you know, the history that we were taught is nothing like what really happened. When you start learning about the how well managed this country was and how simple we had it and how we lived in balance and harmony, you know, that's when, yeah, you start to really want to know more and more and more, and that's what this next episode will do for us. I think it'll start giving us that picture of how we lived in balance and harmony and the genius systems that we live by and the law, that strong law that we had.
Deadly.
Thanks for that, sis. That was
Thank you.
Caillou Bales with us all the way from Stradbroke Island, yarning with us about Decolonize Your Diet. The podcast will be up on our website a little bit later, and we'll chuck it up on our social media. You are listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM. We're just going to head to a quick song break, and we'll be back after that. We're going to go to Uncle Archie Roach with Love in the Morning. You're listening to 98.9 FM.
When I see you.
Yay.
When I see you in the morning light, then I know everything will be alright. Yes, 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 darling, I love you so. Said I love you so. And when I hear you, like an angel song, then I know that you will make me strong. Yes, 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 and together we will grow. Said that we will grow. Touch your body and I touch your soul. Oh, 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 me darling, till I grow. Oh, oh, when I feel, oh, whenever I feel this way, I try to keep it with me through the day. Gift I know, hey, oh, it makes
And you're back on 98.FM. This is Let's Talk, and I'm your host, Bo Spearham. Joining me in the studio again for another day is Carver Watson.
Yeah,
and we were just yarning with Kylie Bales, Carver's
niece.
Yeah. Living on Shrubrock Island, and Kylie and her son produced a really, really deadly podcast. We aired the first 10 of one of 10 series. We had aired the first one last night at 6 p.m. The podcast will be up on our website.
I think it's up now.
Okay,
so if jump on the website, have a look
at 989fm.com.au. Follow the links to podcast,
yep,
and then you'll see Decolonize Your Diet
episode one.
Yes, and on the phone with us now, joining us all the way from Perth, we have Temi Solinek. Temi is the Indigenous Rights Manager at Amnesty International. I've spoken with Temi quite a few times now regarding the issues of young people, not just young Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people in youth detention across Australia. The last time we spoke, it was regarding a young Maori boy in Banksia Hill Youth Detention Centre. And I think the time before that there, we were yarning a bit about what was going on in Dondale. And we're going to yarn today on the program about what's happening in the Northern Territory right now regarding the incarceration rate of young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander or young Aboriginal kids in the NT. Temi, how you going?
Yeah, good, thanks. Thanks for having me, Bo.
That's all good. And just before we start, could I get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from?
Yeah, so my name is Temi Solinek. I'm a Nyingana woman from Derby in the Kimberley of Western Australia, but I'd like to acknowledge the Whadjuk Noongar people because I've lived in Perth now for like 26 years. It's been an honour to work and live alongside the Noongar people.
Deadly. And shout out to Derby. I think we go to Derby, don't we?
Yeah, Roeburn as well.
Roeburn.
Roeburn. Oh, my sister's up in Karratha. Works in Roeburn.
I always forget the name of the radio station, but sis, but they take Let's Talk,
yeah,
and they're really big fans of Wild Black Women.
Yeah.
Sister Girl was on there.
They were on the show the other week.
Yeah. So big shout out to them up there in Roeburn and Derby. But yes, like this is, I get yeah. Well,
100% Indigenous young people in detention. Mm-hmm. What's the story behind this? I mean, Western Australia is renowned and NT is renowned for this hard on youth sort of policy. You know, one of the things I guess that that people will read when they see this statistic is, well, if they're doing the wrong thing, shouldn't they be punished?
we always hear that.
Yeah, and I guess from a perspective, from the Amnesty International perspective, why should we be looking at, you know, the over-incarceration of Indigenous young people differently? Why is it not just a case of they've done the wrong thing, so, you know, they should be punished?
Well, for a start, we're talking about children here. So, you know, it's never really fair just to blame things on children when they're looking at criminal activity. And, you know, most children who are committing crimes and ending up in the justice system come from some form of disadvantage. You know, they're either born into poverty. We've seen the Telethon Institute studies to show that a lot of children that end up in detention have some form of brain injury or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and most of them are dealing with trauma of some sort. So it's pretty unfair to blame their behaviour on that when it's often things that are outside their control. And looking at the over-representation of Indigenous children in the justice system, you know, this is not a new thing. It's shocking, of course, to hear that 100% of the kids in the Northern Territory that are locked up are Aboriginal, and very high rates in all the other states and territories, but it's not new. We've known that this over-representation has been happening for a long time, and that's why we've been doing this campaign. We're an international human rights organisation, and we know that this is a humanitarian crisis to have so many of one race locked up in a country where, you know, colonisation has been perpetrated on that race, and it all goes back to colonisation, really. So there's a lot to untangle to end the over-representation and to help our children so that they don't end up at this cycle of the criminal justice system.
And we've seen, like, over the last 2 weeks, the world's been watching the United States and how, you know, like, this new policy on removing supposed immigrants from, you know, United States. And then there's this, you know, there's been these images and videos of them, you know, locking young children up in cages. You know, Australia's, you know, social media has been blowing up over the last week and a half, but not really so for a lot of our mob and regarding what's happening in the NT at the moment.
Yeah, no, the contrast is quite incredible. And, you know, when we saw those horrifying images of children in detention centres in America, everyone was rightly outraged by that, you know, and global condemnation. But this has been happening to our kids for ages. I was quite touched by the contrast, you know, and that in here in Australia, people feel like it's justified to take our children, whether it be for out-of-home care or into the juvenile justice system, because they're perceived to be doing something wrong. But, yeah, it's an outrageous thing anywhere to take children from their families.
You sort of touched on it there before, being an international aid organisation, you know, I guess part of Amnesty International's sort of makeup is an understanding of, I guess, you know, the complexities of social disadvantage and how that manifests in things like overrepresentation in prison.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you find it difficult to be having these conversations and trying to lobby, like we talk about it all the time, the difficulty in trying to articulate and change the mind of policymakers, i.e. politicians and government, to actually look at it as a social issue and as a sort of humanitarian issue around redressing social disadvantage? And in redressing those things, you start to see changes in, you know, these poor outcomes. But it seems to, like, they prefer this very simple, oversimplified view of they're doing the wrong thing, punish them, because that gets votes.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's all, you know, to do with the political cycle, but also to do with the psyche of Australians. You know, this country was colonised as a penal settlement. That was the first use by the British of Australia, was to bring convicts out here and start more prisons. So it's part of this psyche. You know, we've grown up thinking that this system of tough on crime and punishing people in prisons is the right way. But it's very different to, of course, the ways of punishment that Aboriginal people used to use traditionally, and you know, costs a lot of money in America. All the reforms that are coming out of there with justice reinvestment, that started from economic think tank because they couldn't afford to keep doing it. So there's a lot of growing evidence to show that the current system is broken, that it's not working that there's lots of great alternatives that will address the underlying causal factors so that people are not getting interacting with the justice system in the first place. And in relation to your question, do policymakers get that? I think they do. But like you say, it's about the elections and it's almost like they're too scared to come out publicly with some of this stuff sometimes for fear of the backlash. So we do see things happening behind the doors, but it's not quick enough. And because we're just 3% of the population, our issues are not election winners. So I'm probably better off getting this work done within the periods of the parties rather than at the election time, because it can make and break elections. But that doesn't take it away from being a humanitarian crisis. And that's why big aid agencies and big human rights organisations like Amnesty International are stepping in.
And I guess the alternative models that I guess we do see are things termed like restorative justice models or, and diversionary programs and that sort of stuff. I guess, from the perspective of Amnesty International, where should the focus start to be sort of shone in terms of, a way forward in reducing these rates?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. First thing is that there's a whole need for legislative reform across Australia. Like here in Western Australia, we still have mandatory sentencing of children. That's got to change. One of the things that we've been arguing for in terms of a legislative reform is to raise the age of criminal responsibility. So in Australia currently, we lock up 10 and 11-year-olds and 12 and 13-year-olds all across the country. So the age of criminal responsibility is 10. But the minimum age of criminal responsibility, according to the United Nations Convention Committee on the Rights of the Child, is 12. That's the very minimum. And most countries are aspiring to higher. For example, China's age of criminal responsibility is 16. Everyone's like, China's is not a human rights country, but they're doing heaps better than us in terms of the way they treat children. So there's this campaign underway, Raise the Age. Northern Territory committed to raise to 12 in the Northern Territory Royal Commission, but we're urging for 14 across Australia. That will bring us into line with most European countries, most developing democracies, or developed democracies, I should say. So those sort of legislative reforms and the sort of reforms that we're seeing happening in the Northern Territory and Queensland are all really important. But if we are going to have those reforms, especially raising the age, that will mean they can't lock up children who are under 14. So then we need alternatives to detention for kids who are in trouble or who, their parents need help with. So we've been calling for Indigenous-led solutions for some time. Mm. Programs like Bush Mob, programs like the Mona Horsemanship Program or Yinda up in Townsville, all of these organisations really struggle for funding. They need better support. It needs to be done in a much more strategic way where there's real money set aside to help these diversionary and intervention programs.
Amnesty International's been, sort of in this space fighting, to raise the age of young people and also support community-led organisations all over the country for quite some time. This was before, the Don Dale incident with young Dylan happened. This was before the Royal Commission, and then also as of late before what was happening in Perth with that young Maori boy, and also before, NT just announced that they have 100% young people incarcerated. These are long. When these things come up, does this sort of knock you off your feet, or does it make you more determined to sort of this needs to be done for these young people?
It is frustrating. We have been working on this issue for some time, probably since about 2012, we did some initial research, but our first reports were launched in 2015, a West Australian report, a national overview, then our Queensland report in 2016. And we didn't do a report on Northern Territory because of the Northern Territory Royal Commission. It is a bit frustrating sometimes when you're putting all this effort in and you're seeing some really good gains. We've had a Royal Commission. It's not a little thing. And the whole independent review in Queensland. but you're not seeing those reduction in the numbers yet. And so that's why we're calling for like things like raise the age. So raising the age will mean kids that under 14 can't go to jail, so that will bring down the numbers. And a lot of these early intervention programs and diversionary programs are helping stopping kids from getting into the system, so, but that's not really helping the kids that are in there now. So, you know, it's a multi-pronged approach. We do hope to start seeing the numbers improve. What we actually had seen is when there had been improvements in youth justice system, those improvements were benefiting the non-Indigenous children more quickly than the Indigenous children. So even though the rates were going down, the over-representation was still really high or at times going up. So that was frustrating. Mm-hmm. but we are having gains. Look, we do have to remember we're having gains and that there has been more attention on this issue in the last few years than you know than I'd ever seen in my lifetime. So we remain hopeful and we remain committed to this issue. It's not like something you can come and fly into a community and do a little bit of work. You've got to do it in a sustained way. So, for example, just this week, last week, my team have been out to the Northern Territory. They visited Bush Mob in Alice Springs and 7E News at Boorooloola and Balunyu in Darwin. That's a program that David Cole runs. So, you know, we have to constantly maintain those relationships and work with these organisations.
Mm. You sort of, at the top of the yarn, we spoke about, you know, just how sort of, how vast this problem is when you look at it as a social issue. And, you know, from my work in youth justice and experience with youth justice, you know, it's one thing to work with an individual, but as good as a diversionary program is, you know, that they go to a camp or they go to a men's group or they go to a, you know, whether it be a sort of, you know, station hand sort of program or a men's program, they still return to a family and a community that may be suffering from all of the, you know, the ailments of poverty. It's not just an individual thing, is it? When we're talking solutions to this issue.
Absolutely not. It needs to be looked at holistically. And in fact, the programs that we're working with, the ones that seem to have the most success in terms of stopping repeat offending of children are the ones that work holistically with the family members. And it's not just a camp. They just don't go to a camp. Once they finish the camps, they're provided with support for the children and their families with whatever they're dealing with, whatever issues have come up when they're out in these programs. And that is probably the best approach. You know, it can't be just a once-off, but that all takes money, you know? And so this is sort of, you know, where we're at now. We're trying to establish the base of organisations and seeing what's out there so, you know, we can urge the government to properly fund, sustainably fund these organisations. And that's not necessarily just about money. Sometimes there's governance stuff too to help the organisations, you know, write their tenders and do the evaluations and all of that sort of stuff.
But it does take, you know, politicians, and governments to actually carve out a budget and say we are going to invest in this. You know, there is a return, a financial and a social return in terms of investing in, you know, different ways of dealing with these with the issue.
Yeah, definitely, it does take political will. You know, we've seen this in America. I often point to California, where they've closed 5 juvenile detention centres because the diversionary and the justice reinvestment framework that's been put in place there is so great that the crimes aren't being committed anymore. That's where we want to get to. We want to get to the point where jails aren't needed.
Mm. How many youth prisons are there in the NT?
So there's just one in Alice Springs and one in Darwin.
And
then the Alice Springs Correctional Centre. And both, you know, had so many problems that came out in the Royal Commission.
Mm-hmm. And what were the numbers of the young fellas in there that, you know, yeah?
Yeah, so the stats that came out, there's stats from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, which look on an average day across 2016-17. And then there's the stat that was provided in Parliament about that day. So that stat said that there was 100%. But when you look at the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare stats I can give you them. So mm-hmm. in the Northern Territory, 95% of the children were Indigenous for 2016-17. So that was 30, and these are not huge numbers. Let me give you the numbers. That was 37 Indigenous kids and 2 non-Indigenous, so a total of 39 kids in the Northern Territory. Mm. Western Australia had a 73% Indigenous cohort, so that was 107 Indigenous prisoners, non-Indigenous 38, total of 146. It's a lot bigger than Northern Territory, those numbers. And the numbers with the Northern Territory reflect some of the reforms happening there, whereas Western Australia is still falling behind. Queensland has a total of 182 kids in youth prisons, and that was 71% Indigenous. South Australia had a total of 60 kids, 58% were Indigenous. New South Wales had a total of 278 kids, 53 were Indigenous. Tasmania only had 11 kids in their detention centre, but 3 of them were Indigenous. The Australian Capital Territory only had 8 kids, but 2 were Indigenous. And in Victoria, there was 189 kids and 31 were Indigenous. But then when you look at the over-representation, so nationally, our kids are 24 times more likely to be in detention. In New South Wales, it's 21 times. In Victoria, it's 13 times. In Queensland, it's 30 times. In my home state here of WA, it's 41 times, and the top one actually was South Australia at 42 times. The 3 remaining jurisdictions of the ACT, Tasmania and the Northern Territory, they didn't do the times because the numbers were too small. But yeah, South Australia has really popped ahead of Western Australia in terms of the over-representation, which I hadn't anticipated. That's the first time I've seen South Australia so high. You know, any way you look at it, this is a human rights crisis for Aboriginal people.
Definitely. Just in wrapping up, Tammy, is there anything else that you'd like to finish on?
Look, we want to thank all your supporters for the continued support for the work that we do and for the reforms that are happening in youth justice. But like I said before, there's a long way to go. It needs sustained help. So, you know, ask people to get on board and join the campaign. And also just, you know, where you can share stories and keep this issue in the spotlight, because the more it's in the spotlight, the more people are talking about it, the more leverage we're going to get when we're doing the lobbying and working with the politicians to try and get the legislative reforms and the, you know, the budget changes to support the organisations to do the diversion.
Now, is there somewhere people can go to support these Change the Age campaigns and that sort of stuff, a Facebook or GetUp thing?
So it's just, if you just our campaign is called Community is Everything. You can Google that, and that will come up and give you a whole heap of resources. There's a number of petitions. Even if you just do Amnesty Indigenous Australia, it's our main campaign, it'll come up pretty easily. There's lots of ways to get involved, and we've got staff across the country. Even if you just ring any of our Amnesty offices across the country, we can advise how you can be more involved.
Dudley, thank you for that there, Tammy, and for joining us on the program this morning.
Thanks, Bo. Have a great day.
That's all good. You too. If you're just listening to the program, if you just tuned in, my guest on the program this morning has been Tammy Soliak, and we've been yarning about, I guess, the crisis in the NT at the moment with the youth detention centres being 100% Indigenous. All the young kids locked up there have been, are Aboriginal. So we've been yarning with Tammy about that. And also in the first half of the program, we yarned with Caillou Bales about the new podcast that we have here on 98.9 FM, which you can hear from 6 p.m. every Wednesdays. And also, and her podcast was Decolonize Your Diet. I want to say a big thank you for those two guests for coming on the program this morning, and also for Kava for coming in for the yarn.
No worries. Thanks for having us.
And you've been listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM.
No more boomerang. No more spear. Now we are civilized. Color bar and beer. No more crabby. Gay dance and din. Now we got the movies. paid to go in. Lay down the stone axe, take up the steel. Work like a nigger for a white man's meal. No more boomerang, no more spear. Now we all civilized, color bar and beer. Bunyip, he finished. Now we got instead white fella Bunyip. Call him red. No more sharing what the hunter brings. Now we work for money and pay it back for things. No more boomerang, no more spear. Now we all civilized, got color bar and beer. Lay down the woomera, lay down the waddy. Now we got the atom bomb and everybody. No more boomerang, no more spear. Now we all civilized, got color bar and beer.
Don't you wish there was a how-to guide to parenting? If you're new to it, your mob will probably have given you a ton of advice already. But if you don't have that kind of support, you could check your local AMS for a Mums and Bubs group, like the one at the North Coast Aboriginal Corporation for Community Health. Charlene Terry is a midwife at the health service.
For mums, they don't have to go to the clinic. Everything's brought to them at home, which is really good. Some mums like it. Some mums would rather just get out of the house, go to the clinic, but it's entirely up to them. They've got a choice to decide what they want to do. But we just give them information and then hopefully they're empowered to make the right choice.
The North Coast Aboriginal Corporation for Community Health is for mob on the Sunshine Coast and Gympie and surrounds. To access their programs, call 5346 9800.
A message from the Staying Strong Project, funded by the Australian Government Department of Health.
Don't sing me an anthem, 'cause you don't know the words. Words are hard to remember when they mean nothing at all to the heart who's still waiting for their voice to be heard. Don't sing me your anthem when your anthem's absurd.